If you're an RIA or looking to become one, Schwab Advisor Services is the Watson to your homes. Smart, dependable, always has your back. It's no mystery why they're the number one choice for RIAs who want to be the ultimate solution for their clients. With all the wealth services, technology, and support your firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Follow the clues at schwabvious.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Nightmare in Wisconsin.
The trial of Taylor Shabusiness. Accusations of first-degree intentional homicide, strangulation, mutilation, dismemberment, and necrophilia.
We bring you raw, unfiltered courtroom audio from the trial of Taylor Shabusiness. Nightmare in Wisconsin.
Question, your silence is requested.
Okay. Be seated. All right. You should have now a copy of the instructions that I propose to give to the jury. And again, I will give this before closing arguments. I'll start with the modified 100. There's one missing. Well, in any event, there's the add-on at the end of 100, but I'll get to that in a minute. I'm going to give 315. I'll give 640, the mental disease or defect expert opinion testimony. 605, instruction on the issue of the defendant's criminal responsibility. 160, closing arguments of counsel. Then you can do closing arguments. And then the closing instruction, 460, after you've completed your closing arguments. I've added the verdict form. And the verdict form actually needs to have the heading on it. And I'll make sure that that gets corrected before it goes into the jury. But I did fix the request you had, Mr. Frelick. So the question one is, at the time the crime was committed, did the defendant have a mental disease or mental defect? And I did that for question two as well. And in the instructions, when I indicate you're going to be getting this verdict form, I made that correction there as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know what? I think what I was thinking was missing. I don't think it is missing. I was thinking 602 needed to be inserted in 100. But that's true, but in the first phase of the trial. And so I think that's where... I think I was thinking of 602, and 602 doesn't need to be inserted in 100 at this phase. Okay. That's what I propose to give, counsel. I'm going to start with you, Mr. Saunders. Any objection to the form of the instructions or the verdict form?
Just on the verdict form, question one, I think it should read at the time the crimes were committed, plural, instead of the singular.
Right. Because we're dealing with three, so that should be corrected. So 5, question 1, at the time the crimes were. Any objection to that, Mr. Fraley?
No, that makes sense. Crimes were. That's what we're talking about.
Okay. Anything else, Mr. Stone? Just the same
thing. Oh, there's one more instance. In the top of 605. The defendant's mental condition at the time of the offenses.
Sure. Makes sense as well. Mr. Fraley, any disagreement with that?
Your Honor, are we talking 605, the number one?
605, the very first sentence says, you have just heard testimony about the defendant's mental condition at the time of the offense, and they're suggesting it should say offenses.
I agree.
Anything else, Mr. Saunders?
I guess it's also on the next page, the first question heading.
What's on that same page, number one? At the time the crimes were committed.
Those are fixed. I don't think it appears any other place. Anything else, Mr. Saunders?
No.
All right. Mr. Fralick, anything concerns about the form of the verdicts, the form of the instructions or the verdict?
Your Honor, I see what Mr. Saunders was talking about on that second page, where it's in writing. The first question is, and then it should say at the time the crimes were committed.
We've caught that already.
Okay. But on the first page, what I was talking about, we corrected that first paragraph with an S for offenses.
Yes.
But then if we look down, it says two questions, and then it's got question one and question two. Was that changed to at the time the crimes were committed?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure. Thank you.
And just so everyone knows, I'm not intending to go back and get that corrected now. I will make sure my judicial assistant corrects that as I'm listening to closings. And when this is delivered to the jury, they will have it corrected.
Okay, thank you.
And in addition, as I've indicated, I'm also going to have the heading inserted on the top of the verdict form. So instead of the title of 605B, which is where this verdict form comes from, it'll have the heading in this case. If there's nothing else, then I'm going to use the same time limits as we had yesterday, but they're going to be flipped. So yesterday I gave the state a half hour and 10 minutes of rebuttal. That's what you'll get, Mr. Fralick, but the state will get 35 minutes for their closing. I'm not sure if you're going to need that much time. The time that I've given everyone each time, they haven't used, but I will keep track of that for this time.
Okay.
Anything else before we bring the jury in, Mr. Saunders?
No.
Mr. Fralick.
No, thank you, Judge.
Instruct you upon the principles of law which you are to follow in considering the evidence and in reaching your verdict. It is your duty to follow all of these instructions. Regardless of any opinion you may have about what the law is or ought to be, you must base your verdict on the law I give you in these instructions. Apply that law to the facts in the case which have been properly proven by the evidence. Consider only the evidence received during this trial and the law given to you by these instructions, and from these alone, guided by your soundest reason and best judgment, reach your verdict. If any member of the jury has any impression of my opinion as to the issues in this phase of the trial, disregard that impression entirely and decide the issues of fact solely as you view the evidence. You, the jury, are the judges, are the sole judges of the facts, and the court is the judge of the law only. A defendant in a criminal case has the absolute constitutional right not to testify. The defendant's decision not to testify but must not be considered by you in any way and must not influence your verdict in any manner. Ordinarily, a witness may testify only about facts. However, a witness with specialized knowledge in a particular field may give an opinion in that field. In determining the weight to give this opinion, you should consider the qualifications and credibility of the witness, the facts upon which the opinion is based, and the reasons given for the opinion. Opinion evidence was received to help you reach a conclusion. However, you are not bound by any witness's opinion. In resolving conflicts in opinion testimony, weigh the different opinions against each other. Also consider the qualifications and credibility of the witnesses and the facts supporting their opinions. The court has appointed Dr. Christina Engen to examine the defendant and to testify at trial. You should weigh the testimony of Dr. Christina Engen as you would weigh any other opinion testimony. You have just heard testimony about the defendant's mental condition at the time of the offenses. You will now be asked to determine whether the defendant is not responsible by reason of mental disease or defect. This issue will be presented to you in the form of two questions. First, at the time the crimes were committed, did the defendant have a mental disease or mental defect? Second, as a result of the mental disease or mental defect, did the defendant lack substantial capacity either to appreciate the wrongfulness of the conduct or to conform that conduct to the requirements of the law? You will be asked to answer the second question only if you answer the first question yes. Before you may answer a question yes, the defendant must satisfy you to a reasonable certainty by the greater weight of the credible evidence that the answer to that question should be yes. Evidence has a greater weight when it has more convincing power than the evidence opposed to it. Credible evidence is evidence which, in the light of reason and common sense, is worthy of belief. The first question is, at the time the crimes were committed, did the defendant have a mental disease or mental defect? Mental disease or defect is an abnormal condition of the mind which substantially affects mental or emotional processes. The term mental disease or defect identifies a legal standard that may not exactly match the medical terms used by mental health professionals. You are not bound by medical labels, definitions, or conclusions as to what is or is not a mental disease or defect to which the witnesses may have referred. You should not find that a person is suffering from a mental disease or defect merely because the person committed a criminal act, or because the unnaturalness or enormity of the act, or because a motive for the act may be lacking. An abnormality manifested only by repeated criminal or otherwise antisocial conduct does not constitute a mental disease or defect. A voluntarily induced state of intoxication by drugs or alcohol or both does not constitute a mental disease or defect. A temporary mental state which is brought into existence by the voluntary taking of drugs or alcohol does not constitute a mental disease or defect. Chronic use of drugs or alcohol may produce a condition that can constitute a mental disease or defect if the condition has become permanent. If you answer the first question yes, you must go on to answer the second question. If you answer the first question no, you should not consider the second question. The second question is, as a result of the mental disease or mental defect, did the defendant lack substantial capacity either to appreciate the wrongfulness of the conduct or to conform that conduct to the requirements of the law? If you answer both of these questions yes, the defendant will be found to be not responsible for the offense and will be committed to the Department of Health Services and will be placed in an appropriate institution unless the court determines that the defendant would not pose a danger to herself or to others if released under conditions ordered by the court. In deciding whether the defendant is responsible for the criminal conduct, you are to consider only the issue of the defendant's mental condition at the time the offenses were committed. Agreement by 10 or more jurors is sufficient to become the verdict of the jury. Jurors have a duty to consult with one another and to deliberate for the purposes of reaching agreement. At least the same 10 jurors should agree in all the answers made. I ask you to be unanimous if you can. At the bottom of the verdict, you will find a place provided where dissenting jurors, if any, will sign their names and state the answer or answers with which they do not agree. Either the blank lines or the space below them may be used for that purpose. Consider carefully the closing arguments of the attorneys, but their arguments and conclusions and opinions are not evidence. Draw your own conclusions from the evidence and decide upon your verdict according to the evidence under the instructions given you by the court. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the attorneys will make their closing arguments, and as indicated, because of the different burden of proof in this case, Mr. Freilich will start. Mr. Freilich, are you prepared to make a closing argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Your Honor, may it please the court, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, Mr. Saunders, Mr. Lissay. I want to thank you again for your attention. I know that you've been thinking and analyzing and listening very attentively to the testimony from these experts in phase two of this trial. Now, the question is whether or not Taylor D. Shabizis is legally responsible for the crimes that she's been convicted of. And in this case, Taylor Shabizis has elected not to testify. That's her right. You are not to use that against her in any way, shape, or form. This case is a battle of the experts. We have Dr. Seipel, we have Dr. Engin, and we have Dr. Leighton. The case started off by my client's father, Arturo Coronado, who came in and he testified that his daughter had some problems, some mental health problems, growing up as an adolescent, that he got her some treatment, some counseling, some professional help, that he helped her at Nicolet Psychiatric Center, and that my client lived with him for a period of time. So he provided the framework and the background for some of the issues that this young lady has. And we heard about the fact that her mother died in the home and she was there. And that was a pivotal event in her life because she loved her mother. Then we moved on to Dr. Diane Lighton, PhD, a doctor, forensic psychologist. And she provided testimony as to her extensive background, her training and experience. And she provided testimony that she worked at UW-Madison as a scientist, that she completed over 3,000 hours of post-doctoral training at Mendota Mental Health Institution, a well-known institution that treats people with mental health problems, and that she became a licensed psychologist in 1993. She worked there doing competency evaluations, NGI evaluations, many other evaluations. And then in 1997, she went and became an independent forensic psychologist where she conducted hundreds of forensic evaluations, including competency, NGI, not guilty by reason of insanity, or not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. We call it NGI. Evidence-based sentencing and guardianship. And so she testified about her background and her resume. Lawyers call it a curriculum vitae, her CV. Bores out all of the experience that she has working in this field, technical field. And she went on to testify about the fact that she met with Taylor Shabizis in February of 2023 at the Brown County Jail. And Mrs. Shabizis was nonverbal, nonresponsive, apparently through a chair. She tried another approach where Dr. Lighton met with her behind glass and didn't really get any response. Then we heard about the fact that she did meet with Ms. Shabizis in June of this year, and she was able to conduct her interview and glean and garner information with regards to her mental status and this report that she was tasked with. And I submit that Dr. Lighton testified that she didn't have to do an MMPI, a Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. She was able to gather enough information from reviewing all of the other materials and information that she had. Interviews, consults with the prior attorney, with me, reviewing all of the other doctors' reports, Dr. Lucetta, Dr. Seipel, Dr. Collins, and other doctors that have been involved in this case. She reviewed police reports, looked at interviews, looked at the criminal complaint, looked at Brown County jail records, looked at Nicolet Psychiatric Center records when my client was inpatient there, looked at her school records. Looked at the Bell and Health records. Looked at a lot of information. Basically, what we have here is Dr. Lighton, who's very experienced. She did the NGI evaluation. You heard from Dr. Seipel, Matthew Seipel, that he did a competency evaluation. He did not do the NGI evaluation. Dr. Christina Engine, she's the one that did the NGI evaluation. Now, as it relates to Dr. Lighton, she is of the opinion, to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty, she testified that Ms. Shabizis, Taylor Shabizis, qualifies for the NGI plea based on her diagnosis of a serious mental disorder. The serious, she opines, she concludes, that the serious mental disorder affected Taylor Shabizis's ability to know right from wrong at the time of the alleged offense, dating back to February of 2022, and affected her ability to control her behaviors. And she finds and opines that Taylor has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder for at least several years. And that was confirmed in the records from Bellin Health. She also says and opines that Ms. Shabizis continues to have prominent psychotic symptoms and has not used substances for at least 1 year. There was some talk about the feigning, the faking, the malingering, feigning means faking, about that topic. And Dr. Leighton indicated that it was her opinion that my client was psychotic at the time of the alleged offense, and it wasn't simply due to drug use. Clear, it's clear that Taylor Shabizis had a problem with methamphetamine, with drugs, marijuana, other drugs maybe. Dr. Leighton says that Ms. Shabizis had a very strange presentation, had facial expressions that can appear inconsistent with the context. If you're talking to her about something, she might smile or grin, and it may not be the appropriate time for that. But she opines that her assessment finds that Taylor Shabizis has a genuine mental disorder of a psychotic nature, which is most likely bipolar 1 disorder. Now, in this case, you heard that Dr. Engine, with respect to her, she didn't know that my client was under a civil commitment order for Brown County by Judge Lee Joyce. Taylor Shabizis was found by the court to be the subject of a civil commitment, and that's why she went to Nicolet Psychiatric Center. My client was also the subject of an order for voluntary medication. She had to take medications ordered by the court. No ifs, ands, or buts. Why? Because she was deemed to be having a mental illness. So that's something, ladies and gentlemen, that you should really strongly, seriously take into account, that in April of 2021, for a six-month period, she was under a civil commitment order because she was mentally ill. When you look at the report from Dr. Seipel, or you heard about his testimony, I would argue that his focus is on competency, and competency and NGI are two legal theories, two legal issues that have to be determined separately. But his focus is on competency, and that I would argue that his testimony is not relevant, not germane to the issues that you are tasked with, and that is to determine if my client is NGI, if she meets that criteria. Dr. Seipel, although he's a PhD, his training and experience is much less than Dr. Leighton's. But his focus was competency, and that's not why we're here. Dr. Engen, she testified, and she met with my client on October 12th, 2022, and then again on October 21st, 2022, it appeared that on October 12th of 2022, there was some security issues, so she wasn't necessarily able to meet with my client. But she did meet with my client on October 21st of 2022 and had a three-hour interview with my client. That's 9 months ago. It's a long time ago. I would argue and submit to you that her report is stale. She didn't receive the Bellin records. She didn't look at those records. Someone else could have given her the records. Maybe Dr. Seipel, he's on the same letterhead. And Dr. Seipel knew that he was doing his evaluation. There was a disconnect. There was no communication between the two doctors, which is something you should consider. There was no connectivity there. Also, with due respect, Dr. Engin, you know, didn't trek from Milwaukee to the Brown County Jail to meet with Ms. Chavisnes to do further assessments or supplements. Didn't do anything to supplement the report. So that's something you should take into account as well. There's a instruction, I believe the judge already gave it to you, but it indicates chronic use of drugs or alcohol may produce a condition that can constitute a mental disease or defect if the condition has become permanent. Something to take into account here. We believe that Dr. Lighton was very clear that Taylor Chavisnes has bipolar 1 disorder, that she has psychiatric symptoms, she has mental health problems. And she made that clear. She talked about the fact that Taylor Chavisnes heard the train, heard the whistle, that Ms. Chavisnes lacked volitional control, lacked the ability to control herself, that she is a psychotic person off the scale, that she has a very unusual presentation. And she testified that Taylor Chavisnes, when she interacted with Dr. Lytton, that Taylor tried really hard to answer her questions, but Ms. Chavisnes was distracted by internal stimuli, the clock, the cord, voices telling her to hang herself, the train with the whistle that got louder and louder. Talked about 007 and James Bond when she was asked about her mood. Dr. Lytton talked about hypersexuality, and that was a concern for Dr. Lytton, and about OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, where Ms. Chavisnes was washing her hands 30 to 40 times or touching her hair, things that were a cause for concern. You know, Wisconsin law, we all have to follow the law, and Wisconsin law is such that the defense and a defendant must satisfy you jurors to a reasonable certainty by the greater weight of the credible evidence that at the time the crime was committed that Ms. Chavisnes had a mental disease or mental defect and that as a result she lacked the substantial capacity to either appreciate the wrongfulness of the conduct or conform her conduct to the requirements of the law. And you're going to be given some jury verdicts, basically questions. Not many, just two, I believe. One is, at the time the crime was committed, did the defendant have a mental disease or mental defect? I would submit that the answer would be yes. That's my argument. That's my request that you consider that, and that it was bipolar 1 disorder, based on the testimony from Dr. Litton. Then number two, you'll have to consider, as a result of the mental disease or mental defect, did Taylor Shoebusiness lack the substantial capacity either to appreciate the wrongfulness of her conduct or conform her conduct to the requirements of the law? And you'll have to consider that as well. I would submit that that would be a yes. And I know you know this, but I want to make sure the only issue at this hearing, at this phase two, the second phase of the trial, is Taylor Shoebusiness's mental condition at the time of the offense. So take that into account. It's a difficult case. It's a very complex case. Deals with law, deals with psychology, deals with mental health. A lot of things going on. But I would ask that you take all of this into account when rendering your decision. Thank you very much.
Saunders, okay.
I think it was the dope. I blame it on being on drugs and the come down. I barely do drugs, then months go by, then I do drugs. Admitting on multiple occasions, both to evaluators and to law enforcement, about consuming a significant amount of methamphetamine for these offenses, admitting that she and Chad were toking and methamphetamine beforehand. She even talks about how she was still tweaking on meth during the dismemberment process. Ultimately, that's what this case comes down to, right? Because as we heard from, I think, every doctor, it's difficult to parse out psychotic symptoms versus drug use. So when we're talking about whether somebody has a mental disease or defect, and they're voluntarily ingesting methamphetamine, it's really hard to say that that's due to some other underlying mental health issue, right? And that kind of makes sense in our common sense. But ultimately, that's what this case comes down to. It's the defendant's own words that this was fueled by meth, and now it's, well, no, it's bipolar. It's something else, some diagnosis from way before this offense. And that's not the standard you are to apply. Okay, so first, two questions you'll have. Was Ms. Shoebusiness suffering from a mental disease or defect at the time of the offense? Not in 2012, not in 2014, not in April of 2021, not in June of 2023 when she's meeting with Dr. Litton, or in July with the other doctor, Dr. Seipel. The relevant question is at the time of the offense. Okay. And I disagree with counsel. And you all sat through Dr. Litton's testimony. I don't think it's clear at all that she's diagnosing the defendant with bipolar 1. She said most likely, seemingly based on the prior diagnosis. But there's never a firm diagnosis, and we heard Dr. Seipel comment on that as well. And you also heard about what bipolar entails, right? What's required? What are some diagnostic criteria, right? We heard about these manic episodes that last a week or thereabout, or even longer, where there's this heightened and manic state followed by a depressive state. You've heard none of that What part of the interview the defendant gave to law enforcement on February 23rd indicates that she's still going through some manic episode? What part of all of the witnesses and evidence you've heard about the time and the night of February 21st indicates that she's going through some manic episode? You've heard none of that. So this idea that this manic episode arose and dissipated in a flash, just happening to be around the 5 minutes where she's actually strangling him and then the day that she dismembers Shad, it's utter farce. There's no basis for that. Instead, we're relying on a bipolar 1 diagnosis from April of 2021. It's a year before the offense. And you heard from Dr. Seipel and Dr. Engen, both of whom are court-appointed. State didn't hire them to come. They're the court's appointed experts. Both of them have issues with that initial diagnosis. You heard why, about the concurrent methamphetamine use around the time of the Nicolet admission. And that's the same story we're seeing now, right? It's the same thing. Methamphetamine use exhibiting psychosis, and that's unfortunately what led to Shad's death in this case. It's the same thing. So this concept of a civil commitment and the judge ordered voluntary medication, it's not relevant. It's not consistent with the other evidence you saw in this case. What did you see that led you to think the defendant was going through a manic episode to have bipolar 1 at the time of the offense? That's what's relevant. You're told what a mental disease or defect is. It's something that substantially affects the mental process. That's something else you heard nothing about, right? People can have bipolar 1 and not have their mental state substantially affected. You heard nothing from Dr. Litton to tie that diagnosis, even if we'll give the benefit of the doubt and say she did diagnose bipolar 1, despite the testimony. You heard nothing to tie that into it being a mental disease or a defect. You're instructed that, as we talked about in opening, it's not just because somebody does something really abhorrent and really awful, unnatural. That's not a mental disease or defect. That would be a perverse incentive to sort of reward people to do more deranged things, right? That's not enough. It's not a voluntarily induced intoxicated state. That's what we have here. Mental disease or defect is not a mental state brought about by the ingestion of a controlled substance. So when we heard about meth-induced psychosis, right? Again, that's something that's being brought about by a controlled substance. Those aren't mental diseases or defects. You're responsible in this state for anything you do because you choose to ingest methamphetamine. That's the law. You heard nothing in this case about there being some permanent condition. None of the doctors diagnosed the defendant from suffering from any brain disease because of methamphetamine use or some other substance. Not even her doctors will say that. So when the defense argues that chronic use of drugs or alcohol may produce a condition that can constitute a mental disease or defect, if the condition has become permanent, nobody is testifying to that in this case. That's not any evidence that you heard. You heard and saw the defendant in the time almost immediately before and immediately after this offense, right? We heard from Dr. Seipel about that, and I think the defense fundamentally misunderstands why the state called Dr. Seipel. Obviously, he didn't do an NGI evaluation. We asked him about that. The relevance is because he highlights flaws in Dr. Litton's report, in her opinion, and that's the sole opinion the defendant's relying on to meet Herbert. We heard about why when you're considering, you know, a bipolar diagnosis, particularly in the NGI context, it's really important to look as close as you can to the proximity of the offense, right? And that makes sense, right? It helps validate if this is actually some manic episode or something that would be throwing a chair randomly at a person, right? But there's a difference between those two things. And we heard none of that. We heard none of that from Dr. Litton, did we? We heard a lot about mental diseases and illnesses that she thinks happened way before, way after. And yeah, she reviewed a lot of material, but Dr. Litton tied none of it into February 22nd of 2022, did she? No testimony about, well, okay, so if somebody has bipolar 1, how is that manifesting? How is that utterly inhibiting the defendant from her awareness of what's going on or her ability to conform conduct, right? We heard none of that. We heard a statement at the end that, well, I think she's NGI. I would support the plea. And you heard no analysis, right? No analysis of, well, I considered the defendant's actions the night of the incident, and this raised this concern for me that would support my opinion. We heard none of that, right? And it's their burden to do so. You heard none of that from Dr. Litton. She's, yes, qualified, experienced. We heard about that. But there are real issues with her methodology in this case, based largely, her opinion is, on her interactions with Ms. Shabusiness on June 19th of 2023. And we heard ample reason why that should be a red flag. People who actually administered personality tests to kind of determine feigning and over-exaggerating of symptoms, including experts hired by the defense, have raised that concern for the defendant that she over-reports symptoms, that she exaggerates symptoms. And Dr. Seipel is exactly right. And you heard the testimony from Dr. Litton. Most of her opinions based on her interactions with the defendant and this bizarre behavior that she's observing. Incidentally, bizarre behavior you haven't observed for 1 second during this trial. For the last 4 days, there's no throwing chairs, there's no outbursts, there's no staring or off, right? So this idea that Dr. Litton's opinion based on her interactions with the defendant and some old bipolar diagnosis, there's nothing tying it together. There's nothing showing you that would allow you to agree with her opinion that the defendant had a mental disease or defect on the date of the offense, which is the relevant question you have to answer. You have reported behaviors by Dr. Litton that aren't in any other reports that are observed by doctors. Dr. Seipel meets with her really close proximity, isn't reporting any of these behaviors. And again, one of the questions you have is capacity, right? Substantial capacity to do things. And there's a big difference between capacity and desire to do so with volition, with choice, right? The capacity to go skydiving. I don't have the volition to go skydiving. I have the volition to dunk a basketball. I probably don't have the capacity to dunk a basketball, right? Those are different concepts. And the information you heard about in the records and the testimony is that it's something that the defendant can control to some extent, right? There's no outbursts or any of the behavior Dr. Litton's talking about that Dr. Seipel observes, that the court-appointed expert, Dr. Engen observes. None of that, right? To the contrary, you have Dr. Engen doing scientific tests to determine about the validity of some of the observations and determining the opposite, right? And sure, Dr. Litton was under no requirement to do that sort of testing. But when she says she just looked at the prior results and relied on those, well, what she should have been relying on is that the information the defendant's telling her isn't accurate. That's the only prior analysis that we heard about. So again, there's real methodological issues with Dr. Litton's report. Most importantly, none of it ties together with the date of the offense. Her testimony, for the better part of this morning, maybe two or three questions dealt with the date of the offense, tying it together. Dr. Litton, how are you able to tell this jury that Ms. Shabusiness was unable to conform her conduct, was not aware of what's going on? You heard none of that. She didn't even review the entire video, the recorded interview that you observed, to see firsthand, really close proximity to the date of this offense, what the defendant's behaviors were. She reviewed a transcript. I think she said she may have reviewed 90 minutes of it or something like that. Didn't review the second interview, which incidentally, as you observed, and you heard from Detective Graff, the same behavior, same mannerisms, same lack of outbursts or anything like that throughout this time. Again, this manic episode that is allegedly occurring. You observed that over several days and didn't observe any of that. So that's the concern with Dr. Litton's testimony, and that's the relevance of Dr. Seipel's testimonies. He points out some of these issues. As he interacted with the defendant as well, didn't observe any of that on multiple occasions. As a court-appointed expert, again, not hired by the state to come in and say that, report that. So you have the report from Dr. Engen, the court's expert. And you heard the testimony, and if you review the report, it jives with common sense, right? There's no mental disease or defect that she talks about. The mental illnesses, which there seem to be, are all substance abuse related. And again, the law of this state says that's not enough. That's not a mental disease or defect. So sure, there's, I think, amphetamine disorders and methamphetamine intoxication. She says, yeah, I would support these illnesses. Those aren't mental diseases or defect. She considered a bipolar 1 disorder and rejected it for the reasons we talked about. Given the concurrent use of methamphetamine, it seems like the doctors that the court appointed agree that you're using meth. You're not psychotic. Any psychotic symptoms you're exhibiting are because you took meth, not because you have some diagnosis or of a mental disease or defect. So when you're asked the first question, when you see the verdict form, that question should be answered no. You've heard insufficient evidence that the defendant suffered from a mental disease or defect on February 22nd, 2022. Okay. If you answer that question yes, and only if you answer that question yes, you get to the second question. Second question asks a compound question. As a result of that mental disease or defect, did the defendant lack substantial capacity, again, capacity, to understand the seriousness of her conduct or to conform her conduct to the requirements of law, right? So understanding and conformity are kind of the two things there. So let's talk about that. You obviously heard from Dr. Engen about that, about how she does not support that. She does not believe that she was lacks substantial capacity to have either of those two things, right? And her reasoning makes sense. And really, it's kind of reasoning you probably would have gotten to without her testifying in some respects. It helps that this expert, that the court appointed, comes in and tells you that too. But it jives with common sense, right? Because you heard all this evidence for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and today about the defendant's conduct on February 22nd, 21st, and into the 23rd. She's aware of the wrongfulness of her conduct, and she's telling you as much, right? She tells law enforcement, I took these Clorox wipes and I was wiping up, right? Specifically, even accurately remembering it's Clorox wipes, and where she put them, in the bags. Detective Scanlon on February 28th asks her, hey, we saw some wiping pattern on the floor. I mean, what was going on with that? And she was like, yeah, I was cleaning up. And they're like, well, did you move the bed over it? She said, yes. And why did she say it? Why did she say she did that? She was covering it up. Right? And that's why we asked those questions about the blood that we saw on the floor under the mattress isn't coming, seeping through the mattress. It's coming because the defendant moved the bed over it because she's trying to cover up her crime. And now they want you to believe that she's not aware of the wrongfulness of her conduct? She's telling law enforcement, how am I going to get away with this? That was her motivation for dismembering his body for a lengthy period of time after the fact, hearing footsteps upstairs, worrying mom was going to find him. She's telling you she's aware of the wrongfulness of her conduct, and she's exhibiting action and volition to clean up. everything you're objectively seeing evidence-wise in this case shows you that she knows exactly what's going on. She even remembers details about this night. And now that we hear this professed amnesia in her comments to Dr. Engen about this offense, and you saw the interview, she had every detail down to the T. She could have drawn that entire basement for you from memory. Everything was located. She's telling you where the meth is located, where the dildo is located, what color the dildo was. She's aware of what's going on, even with the meth use. You have her memory of the incident. You're hearing about how she's describing, and you could probably infer from the nature of the offense how blood was going everywhere in the course of the conduct, yet you heard about the condition of that basement, right? It was pretty spotless, pretty clean, especially considering what happened down there. Because she cleaned up. Because she was aware of the wrongfulness of what she did. She didn't just massacre somebody, dismember him, and leave a war zone down in that basement. No, she cleaned up because she knew what was going on. Then you get to the second part, right? If she's able to conform her conduct to the requirements of law. And again, you heard nothing from Dr. Litton to kind of help you with that, right? Like, okay, if I'll accept she has this bipolar diagnosis, well, tell me, Dr. Litton, how is she unable, because of that diagnosis, to conform her conduct on February 22nd? And you heard none of that. To the contrary, as Dr. Engen points out, you have a lot of information to tell you she's able to conform her conduct pretty well. Right? She's employed. We heard about court cases that she was dealing with. We heard about paternity things she was arranging in the time leading up to the offense. We heard about after the fact, we saw the contact with law enforcement, right? She's ordered to take her hands out of her pockets for officers. She does that. Order to put her hands behind her back. She does that. Complying with orders, complying with commands, complying with questions. She's conforming her conduct pretty well, right? She's following the law, law enforcement's commands. In her interview with law enforcement for a lengthy period of time, she's conforming her conduct. She's not exhibiting any manic symptoms. She's not exhibiting any psychosis in that you heard about. There's just nothing in this case to show that she's not able to conform her conduct. To the contrary, you heard a lot of evidence that not only did she not lack that ability to conform her conduct, that what she did to Shad was volitional, was a choice. She liked it. She was aroused by it, right? She told law enforcement that. She wanted to do this. She did. Because that was a volitional choice. It's not because she lacked substantial capacity to not do so. It's because she wanted to do so. And she did. You heard about her saying, well, yeah, I knew I was killing him, but the quote, I did it anyway, right? Because that's what she wanted to do. And again, a mental disease or defect is not because you may not have a clear understanding of a motive. I would say you should, but that's not a mental disease or defect. Just because what she ultimately did is in some respects, quite disturbing, it's not a mental disease or defect. You have insufficient evidence to support that. And again, it's not the state's burden to disprove an NGI plea. I think we have, but it's the defendant's burden to convince you of the NGI plea, and they've utterly failed in that respect. We heard about the burden of proof, that it's a reasonable certainty by the greater weight of the credible evidence. And you should be, even though it's not a burden, I would say you should be reasonably certain the defendant's not suffering from a mental disease or defect. again, it's their burden to convince you that you should be reasonably certain by a greater weight of the credible evidence that she does. And it's their burden. If they wanted the court's expert to review documents from 10 years prior, they could have done so. They could have provided those materials. If they wanted, hey, please interview my client again, they could have done so. It's their burden. And they chose not to. There was additional jail records. They could have produced those. And actually, Dr. Engen's comments about that make sense. You know, her findings and all the objective evidence you have is this is a meth-induced crime, that whether she had a civil commitment a year prior, had, I think, a mood disorder 10 years prior as a 14-year-old, that's not relevant. It wouldn't change anything. I don't understand these arguments about the reports being stale. As Dr. Engen told you, it's a retrospective review, right? We don't really care. You're not asked to decide, does she have a mental disease or defect today? That's not important. The proximity to today isn't relevant. It's the proximity of the offense. You should actually be entirely convinced Dr. Engen's report is the more relevant report. It's closer in time to the actual mental state the defendant had on February 22nd. It's obviously a complex case in some respects, right? It's a serious offense that the defendant was convicted of. It's obviously it's an important case, right? And the defendant has had experiences in her personal life that nobody should have. Losing a parent at a young age, that's something many of us deal with, and it's awful to hear about. It really is. But that doesn't change the law. That doesn't change the standard in this state, because there's simply no evidence to support she had a mental disease or defect on February 22nd, 2022. Not only did she not have a mental disease or defect on that day, you have no evidence to say that mental disease or defect rendered her substantially incapable of conforming her conduct or appreciating the wrongfulness of her conduct. You simply don't have that evidence here. You have ample evidence to the contrary. The defendant is telling you that meth made her do this. She's repeatedly told that to law enforcement. Every objective piece of evidence you have in this case supports that finding. And it's simply the case that is not enough in this state. That's not a mental disease or defect. So don't let her now try to come in and say this was some other thing. That no, now the meth really didn't have anything to do with it. It's important to note, a meth-induced psychotic state is also not a mental disease or defect, as you'll read in the instruction. There's no mental disease or defect. There's no lack of awareness. There's no inability to conform your conduct. You have ample evidence to the contrary. And that leads to one inevitable result, is that she's responsible for what she did to Shad on February 22nd. As a result, you should answer both questions no, or answer the first question no, and don't get to the second question. Thank you.
Mr. Fraley, do you have a rebuttal?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honor, again, may it please the court, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Saunders, Mr. Lissay. You know, this case illustrates that this young lady, Taylor Shabizis, has a lifetime of mental health issues. She has bipolar 1 disorder. That is a mental disease or mental defect. You know, who is the state fooling? We have a young lady that was under a civil commitment order and a medication order by the Brown County Circuit Court in 2021. So she already had a mental health disorder, a mental defect, I submit a mental disease, that predated the incident that has brought us here to court
on February 22nd of 2022. It's clear in this record that Ms. Shabizis was at the Nicolet Psychiatric Center for 3 weeks or so, maybe a month, in 2021. You got to see in phase one of this trial Green Bay Police Officer Garth Russell, who parked his squad down quite a ways, and he walked in the dark of night across the snowy parking lot up to the Eastman Avenue apartment at 2353 Eastman Avenue. And Ms. Shabizis met, or Officer Russell met her at the door out on the porch. And you could see on the video her face. You could see her eyes. You could see her demeanor. She didn't look right. I submit to you, she didn't look right. Something was going on. Did this happen when she was in a manic state or a psychotic state? I submit that, you know, once you have a mental health issue, mental health diagnosis, a mental health issue like bipolar 1 disorder, it's not going away. It follows you for the rest of your life. What we have here is someone who has a very serious mental health issue, mental health disorder. And you pile drugs on top of that. It can constitute a mental disease or defect if the condition has become permanent. I would submit that Taylor has had mental health issues dating back to her early years. She went to Brevea, she went to Bellin, she went to Nicolet, she was under a court order where she had to have injectable antipsychotic medications. She apparently was psychotic when she was at the Nicolet Psychiatric Center. I would submit that it wasn't necessarily from drugs. She's got this underlying issue here. She has ongoing mental health issues. She's only 25 years old, and they've been going on since her youth. I would argue that the mental health issues that she has caused this whole situation, and that'll be something you have to think about. Is she able to appreciate, or was she able to appreciate, the wrongfulness of her conduct on February 22nd of 2022? Was she able to conform her conduct to the requirements of the law at that particular time? And you saw the video. We all saw it. It was very bizarre, very unusual, very odd, her demeanor. You know, in this case, there are a lot of doctors, but Dr. Engine, you know, she never knew about the civil commitment order. Come on. You didn't know about a court order? And she's a PhD, and she deserves respect, but something happened here where it fell through the cracks that she didn't know about this civil commitment order or this medication order. And then we have Dr. Seipel, you know, he got the Bellin records, got them from me. And, you know, he does a report for this case, and I find it incredible. It's incredible that he doesn't send, with due respect to him, he doesn't send the Bellin records over to Dr. Engine, knowing that she's going to come in here and testify in a court of law in front of you jurors. I find that unbelievable. I don't make the law. But the law, you know the law, because the judge read it to you. You have to consider whether she's responsible because of a mental disease or defect. So you've got to think about all of that. The defense didn't fail. There is a plethora of evidence to show her mental health history. Was her bipolar I condition permanent? I submit to you that it was. Did it cause a crazed situation for her on the date of this fatal incident? You heard Detective Roth, who's a very seasoned detective with the Green Bay Police Department. You heard him go through very methodically questions. He was patient. He asked Taylor Shabazz lots of questions about what was going on. And he testified that the police detectives and the officers, it was an ongoing investigation, and they didn't have all the facts. They didn't know all the things that were going on. It was evolving. Detective Scanlon was over on Stony Brook, and Detective Groff was at the police department. Difficulties? She told Detective Groff, I didn't intend to do this. Me and Shad were buddies. Words to that effect. So I submit that she did not want to do this. At the time, was she in a state of psychosis? Who knows? That's for you jurors to decide. But we've presented the lawyers, Mr. Saunders, Mr. Lissay, and I have given you the information, the evidence for you to wrangle with and think about and analyze and assess. I would ask that you consider the fact that Ms. Shabazz was taking the antipsychotic meds, the injectable meds, when she was at Nicolet Psychiatric. And then once she was released, didn't take it anymore. We all know if you don't take your medications, you're going to have problems, especially if it's a mental health condition. If you don't take your high blood pressure medication, what's going to happen? Your blood pressure is going to go up to the sky and you could have a heart attack or stroke. Same thing rings true for other medications. And in this particular case, Ms. Shabazz did not take these medications. So her mental health problems, her bipolar I, got worse and worse and worse and worse to the point where it went off the cliff. I would submit that based on everything that's been presented, I'd ask that you consider returning a verdict that she is not responsible for these crimes by reason of mental disease or mental defect as applied with the jury instruction. Thank you very much.
Now, members of the jury, the duties of counsel in the court have been performed. The case has been argued by counsel. The court has instructed you regarding the rules of law which should govern you in your deliberations. The time has now come when the great burden of reaching a fair, just, and conscientious decision of this case is to be thrown wholly upon you, the jurors selected for this important duty. Do not be swayed by sympathy, passion, or prejudice. You will be very careful and deliberate in weighing the evidence. I charge you to keep your duty steadfastly in mind and as upright citizens to render a just and true verdict. As with the case in the prior phase, you will be getting a copy of these instructions with you during your deliberations. With that, I'd ask the bailiffs to step forward to be sworn.
Do you swear that you will, to the utmost of your ability, keep all jurors sworn on this trial in some private and convenient place, subject to the direction of the court, until they have agreed upon their verdict or are discharged by the court, and that you will not, before they render their verdict, communicate to any person the state of their deliberations or the verdict they have agreed upon, so help you God.
I do.
All rise for the jury.
Anything to bring up before we recess, Mr. Saunders?
No.
Mr. Fralick?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Now, I'd ask, as with the situation the other day, I'd ask if everyone remain around for 30 minutes until 6 o'clock or so. After that point, if you want to leave, if you could just leave a cell phone number where we could reach you. And with that, we are in recess.
Thank you.
You're listening to True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast continuous coverage of the trial of Taylor Shabusiness, Nightmare in Wisconsin.
Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage.
More raw trial audio next.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee, only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.